If you could start out and give our listeners a brief bio of yourself.
William Rivers Pitt, writer for online publication Truth Out, senior writer, senior news editor, author of the book War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, author of the book The Greatest Sedition to Silence, which will be out in June.
We've all just been watching what the media is calling the actual shock and awe campaign on the people of Iraq, and specifically Baghdad. What's your thoughts after watching this for the last couple days?
I feel like I did on September 11th. I feel actually a little bit worse than I did on September 11th, if that's at all possible. September 11th was a terrible shock and a terrible surprise. It was like getting kicked in the gut in a dark room. This, we knew this was coming. We saw it coming. We've been waiting for it to come, and now it's here. And it's us doing it now. Baghdad is a lake of fire at this moment. CBS is reporting that residential neighborhoods are being engulfed in flames. There's nobody jumping out of tall buildings because all the tall buildings have been blown up. They're burning in their living rooms. Baghdad is a city of 5 million people, half of whom are under the age of 15, most of whom are too poor to flee. And they are stuck and burning right now. And we did it. We did this. This is not some nefarious, ambiguous evildoers who hate our freedom situation. This is the United States of America burning innocent civilians in their homes.
Donald Rumsfeld, in his press conference, had just stated that he disagreed with some of the media reports making comparisons to the bombings that occurred during World War II to Germany, Japan, and those that occurred in Vietnam. What's your take on that?
I think that Don Rumsfeld doesn't know his butt from his elbow. I think that Don Rumsfeld will say virtually anything to defray the ultimate ramifications of what have happened here, but people saw this. This was on television. I was sitting here watching this, and it unfolded right in front of my face, and the scale that we're dealing with might not be comparable to the firebombing of Dresden, which basically killed hundreds of thousands of people. But the comparison that the individual, that the reporter was talking about, was questioning the tactical concept here. Rumsfeld and the rest of these guys have been saying that if we do this, they'll throw up their arms and surrender and run to us and say, please stop, don't kill us anymore. The reporter rightly pointed out that we did this in Japan, and in Germany, and in Vietnam, and in each of those cases, the people who were in that city hunkered down and held out and did not run, surrendering into our arms, and why should this be any different? And Mr. Rumsfeld hemmed and hawed and didn't have much of an answer for that.
If we could talk about some of the reasons the U.S. is giving for this current war in Iraq, the leading one is the weapons of mass destruction threat to the U.S. What do you see as the truth to that?
Well, the book that I wrote argued that the weapons of mass destruction threat has been grossly overblown. The ONSCOM weapons inspections from 91 to 98 did an incredible job of destroying not only the weapons themselves, but the infrastructure to create them. The first Gulf War also did a very good job at making sure that most of those weapons were destroyed. Whatever got missed by the war got gobbled up by the inspectors, and everything left, everything else has basically degraded because this stuff has a shelf life. Now, we're rolling up Iraq like a window shade here. We haven't sent troops into Baghdad yet. As hard as it is to believe, the worst of this may still be coming. But I think that the threat of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons posed by Iraq has been just disgustingly overblown and used as a cover for a larger design by the administration to get into Baghdad for the purpose of establishing a permanent military presence in that region.
The co-author of one of your books and the focus of one of your relatively recent articles was Scott Ritter, and one of the examples he gave was talking about the 98 missiles that Iraq turned over. Can you expand on that?
You're talking about back during the weapons inspection.
You were correct, yeah.
There were some 200, I believe, missiles that were unaccounted for. This was one episode that he was using to describe the myth is that Iraq was completely and totally non-compliant throughout the entire ONSCOM weapons inspection process. He was describing a situation where the inspectors came and said, okay, here are these 200 missiles. Where the hell are they? and they were taken to a field where 200 missiles had been completely destroyed and then buried, at which point the inspectors became, in the words of Scott Ritter, forensic archaeologists, dug up every little piece of metal of all the missiles that were destroyed, and compared the manufacturer's numbers on those to the shipping manifests, went back to Russia, who sold them the missiles in the first place, and compared the manifests to the shipping orders at the Russian firm, and discovered that they had accounted for 198 of the 200 missiles, and what was left was a pile of metal with no identifying numbers on them, which was in all likelihood the other two missiles, but because they didn't have any identifying marks on them, they could not be quantitatively described as having been part of the 200 that had been destroyed, which is basically why Iraq was never going to be able to get a 100% clearing that they had destroyed all of these missiles. But it's instructive to note that not only were the inspectors brought to the site where this stuff had been destroyed, but that the Iraqis had in fact destroyed them without being ordered to by anybody.
And yet this doesn't seem to be coming out in the media.
No, of course not. That would obviate the need for a war. Right now, the mainstream media is enjoying a massive ratings surge. I mean, never forget that CNN's ratings went up some 500% on September 11th, and in fact, CNN was birthed in the first Gulf War. So to say that the media has been somewhat cheerleading for this is an understatement, although I'm watching Dan Rather right now, and it looks like somebody kicked him in the stomach.
So how about the ties to terrorists? That was a late thing that the Bush administration tried to spin into the whole picture.
This whole process that we've just watched unfolding has been the greatest terrorism recruitment poster that we have ever undertaken in our lives. The Iraqi regime would not have ties to terrorism. Saddam Hussein is a secular dictator. In his parlance, he's a socialist. He's been crushing Islamic fundamentalism, particularly Wahhabi Islamic fundamentalism in Iraq, for the past 30 years. If you proselytize for fundamentalism in Iraq, they kill you. Osama bin Laden and all of these other groups have been saying for years that they very, very much, very much like to see Saddam Hussein killed. As a matter of fact, Osama bin Laden's tape that came out in February quantified that very clearly for the Iraqi people to rise up against the socialists who are holding them down. If Saddam Hussein were to give any weapons to any of these types of people, they would use those weapons on him first. But right now, starting now, a great many groups of terrorist organizations who really don't give a damn whether Saddam Hussein lives or dies are going to be very interested in coming over here and blowing things up and killing people to avenge all of the Muslims who have just been incinerated in Baghdad. So we've done a great job at recruiting terrorists to come after us here. You can see it on television.
We're talking about how Saddam Hussein is like the next Hitler and that he's committed these war crimes and has these supposed weapons of mass destruction. And yet there doesn't seem to be any focus on the corporations, which my understanding is there's at least 24 U.S. corporations that supplied him with those materials to make those weapons of mass destruction. Why isn't the media covering this?
Because the media is in no small part owned by these corporations. If they're not owned by these corporations, they need the advertising dollars from those corporations to survive. General Electric owns NBC, MSNBC, and CNBC, one of the largest defense contractors on the face of the earth. It's just amazing to think that a company like this is deeply and profoundly involved in the manner in which Americans receive their news. The conflict of interest is inherent here. They're not going to talk about this stuff because of the relationships that these companies have with each other in terms of advertising dollars and simple ownership. It's just not going to come out.
Early on when Iraq turned over its 12,000-page document on its weapons of mass destruction and all the details on that, that the U.S. literally stole that document from the U.N., I believe, to excise the 6,000 to 8,000 pages from it.
Yep.
And did you see where it looks like Denis Kucinich has got them to release that document again?
Denis Kucinich has gotten them to release that, and be interested to see what he has to say when all is said and done. Yeah, those 8,000 pages were excised, and a German reporter for Der Spiegel actually got a hold of it. I think you could probably dig this up somewhere on the net, and outlined the number of companies that are involved in this. And it's fairly amazing, you know, who it was that sold all of these weapons to them. And it wasn't just corporations. According to this Der Spiegel report, the Iraqi scientists were being helped by Los Alamos and Sandia, all of our major nuke facilities. We're also instrumental in teaching these guys how to do this. We were giving them tactical battlefield information during engagements down in the Fal Peninsula in which chemical weapons were used. We were telling them the array of the Iranian forces so that they could more purposefully use these weapons. The hypocrisy involved in this whole process has been astounding.
Yeah, we often hear the different administration officials talking about what Saddam has done in the last 12 years, and they seem to have totally forgotten about the prior 12 years when we put him into power and had a pretty tight alliance with him.
We became best friends with Saddam Hussein in 1979 after another one of our misadventures in the Middle East went horribly wrong when the Shah of Iran was overthrown by the Ayatollah Khomeini. We created the Shah. He was our guy. He was our hedge against the Soviets. And when the Ayatollah took over and all of a sudden started talking to the Soviets, we buddied up with Saddam Hussein immediately as part of the Cold War necessities of the time. And, you know, hey, the Cold War was the Cold War. All of this that we're dealing with right now, from September 11th to this to just about everything else, is all blowback from the Cold War. All these old alliances are beginning to crumble. All of the problems that we, you know, the enemy of our enemy is our friend in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in every place else, is now coming back to bite us on the butt.
One of the key engineers in some of that was Zbigniew Brzezinski with our policy in Afghanistan back in, I believe, late 70s, early 80s. Can you talk about that?
Well, September 11th was born in 1978. Zbigniew Brzezinski, he was the national security advisor for Carter at the time, has started a program of training Afghan Mujahideen out of religious schools in Pakistan to go and start attacking the Afghan government, which was called the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, the PDPA. The purpose for this was not to overthrow the PDPA, which was a puppet regime of the Soviet Union. The purpose was to make the Soviets so nervous that they would invade to prop up their puppet government there. And it worked. I mean, in 1996, Brzezinski referred to this as the Afghan trap. He bragged about it, and it was very effective. The Soviets invaded in 1979, smashed themselves to pieces over the next 10 years, killed, I think it was, 3 million Afghan people, internally displaced another 5 million, tore the country to pieces, and then left. And we, who dared them to invade in the first place, did nothing to help to pick up the pieces afterwards. So a terrible civil war broke out until 1996, when the Taliban finally won control of the country. During this Afghan engagement, one very prominent member of the forces that were fighting against the Soviets, forces the Afghan Mujahideen, who, by the way, we were supportive of both with money and with weapons and with training, a prominent member of this force was a guy named Osama bin Laden. He made his name in Afghanistan fighting the Soviets with our help. In 1996, when the Taliban finally gained control of the country after that terrible civil war, Osama bin Laden was their pampered and protected and most welcomed guest. And then things really started blowing up. The Khobar Towers blew up. The USS Cole blew up. Two embassies in Africa blew up. All from Osama bin Laden, who was protected in Afghanistan by the Taliban. And then, of course, there was September 11th. But that started in 1978 when we instigated an action that caused Afghanistan to be torn to pieces, that allowed the Taliban eventually to take control, that allowed a guy named Osama bin Laden to gain the reputation that he's gotten in the Middle East and to be able to do the things that he's done. Actions have consequences.
And my understanding is up until the time that we wanted Osama bin Laden for trial or for whatever, we were actually fairly cooperative with the Taliban.
There's a lot of business to be had in that part of the world. There's great amounts of natural gas and other minerals up by the Caspian Sea in Turkmenistan, and there was hope for a while, for a long time, from companies like Unocal and other groups within Saudi Arabia. Unocal is an American petroleum company, to run a pipeline from Turkmenistan through Afghanistan into Pakistan and out to a warm water port so that that massive natural gas deposit could be exploited. So Unocal was trying for years to get a pipeline through there, and we were hoping that the Taliban could be the stable, none of the corporate sponsors, none of the corporate money people would jump onto this program because they thought that Afghanistan was too unstable. They needed a stable government, no matter how bad they were, just as long as they were stable enough to drop the funding in to get this pipeline going. And then in 1998, when the embassies were blown up by Osama bin Laden, who was hiding in Afghanistan, the Clinton administration put the kibosh on anybody doing any business whatsoever with Afghanistan. That ended when the Bush administration came in, January 20th, 2001. They started sending emissaries like Lila Helms over there to try and get this pipeline project going again. So there has been a large amount of economic interest in that region. Part of what happened on September 11th has to do with the economics of the region. Guys like John O'Neill, who was he was deputy director of the FBI, the senior bin Laden hunter in America, quit 3 weeks before September 11th because he said that he was not being allowed to do his job by the administration. He was not being allowed to ask hard questions. You know, all roads to terrorism do not lead to Iraq. They lead to Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is in no small way Bush's boss. They're America's boss. They've got all the oil. So we can't do anything to make them angry. So all of these inquiries on terrorism that were headed right back to Saudi Arabia were being quashed and redirected and saying, don't go there, don't do that. You can't ask these questions because we'll make the Saudis angry. And so our ability to see this coming was very, very seriously undermined. And John O'Neill quit. It is one of the most wretched ironies of this whole process. John O'Neill quit 3 weeks before September 11th to take a job as the head of security at the World Trade Center. And he died doing his job on September 11th.
And one of the key conduits to business in Saudi Arabia is the Carlyle Group, I understand, that our current president's father happens to be on the board of.
The Carlyle Group has its fingers in a lot of pies. They're what they are more than anything else, they're a massive money managing. They have about 164 companies that they front and take care of and push here and there. They buy things, and they're very involved in telecommunications. Bush Sr. was over in Saudi Arabia in 2000 pitching a telecommunications firm represented by Carlyle to the royal family over there. Another really interesting aspect of Carlyle's involvement in this whole thing is a company called United Defense. Now, when you turn on the TV and you see tanks roll by, you see armored personnel carriers roll by, you see trucks roll by, you see missiles, you see ship missiles being shot off of ships, those are all built and manufactured by United Defense. United Defense is going to get rich off of this war and going to get rich off of the heightened militarization of this country as per the Bush budget that was passed yesterday or today, I believe, bumping the gross domestic product to be put into the Defense Department up to 3.8%, which, ironically enough, is exactly what the Project for the New American Century white paper on the subject asked for. And a lot of that money is going to go to companies like United Defense and, by proxy, the Carlyle Group, as they get paid to militarize this country.
Talk more about the Project for a New American Century.
It's one of your fairly standard issue, wacky right-wing think tanks that was founded in 1997 on the premise that the United States is the sole remaining superpower. Basically, they're advocates of empire. They call it Pax Americana. America at the point of the sword. You go out and you use your power as the sole remaining superpower to kick a bunch of countries into line and to get what you want and to overthrow countries that you don't like very much. Diplomacy kind of goes right out the window with these guys. In 1997, when they came together, one of the keys to this process was the overthrow of Iraq and to turn Iraq into a place where permanent military bases could be built so as to begin knocking off friendly and unfriendly regimes alike in that region. Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, anybody basically within reach. And westernized that, and one of the signatories of PNAC is this guy named Norman Podhoretz. He's a writer. The underlying premise behind this whole idea is the reformation and modernization of Islam. So we've got a think tank in Washington looking to reform and modernize a religion that's been around for thousands of years. What makes these guys different from any other wacky right-wing think tank in Washington, D.C. are the people who started it, who live by its precepts, and who helped to create the plans that they would like to see happen. Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Richard Perle, William Crystal, and a whole host of other people who are either running the foreign policy of this country right now, running the war right now, or major opinion makers for same. So the Project for the New American Century, and you can read all about them at newamericancentury.org, this is their war. This is their baby. Their white papers are now exploding over the skies in Baghdad. There's a company waiting in Kuwait right now for this whole process to be over with. The company called Brown & Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, which we all know was Dick Cheney's former company. Brown & Root builds bases. That's what they do. They build military bases, permanent military bases. There are something like 12 permanent military bases in the area surrounding Kosovo that were built by Brown & Root. So Brown & Root is getting ready to roll into Baghdad and roll into Iraq after all of the shooting has stopped and after the fires are out and after the bodies are buried, to build the permanent military bases required for the permanent military presence that America is going to have in this region, so that we can start knocking off other regimes in that area, no matter the cost, no matter the kind of terrorism that happens over here. And that's the plan. Sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel.
It does, and it's unfortunate because I think a lot of people, when they hear things like this, they think of, oh, you conspiracy theorists.
Well, if it's a conspiracy theory, ABC News and NBC News and CBS News and Nightline and CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post have all fallen for it because they've all written about it or had programs on it. Nightline recently did a whole thing on Project for New American Century. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's just as bad as it sounds.
Talk a bit, if you would, about the prospects for democracy in Iraq, because that's another sales pitch that the Bush administration is throwing our way.
Slim to none, unfortunately, for them. Iraq is a country that's divided between three different groups: the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. The Shiites make up about 60% of the country. Now, if we were to bring Western-style democracy to Iraq, that means majority rules, and the majority are Shiites. But unfortunately, they are Shiites that are ideologically and theocratically aligned with the hardline mullahs in Iran. So if we were to bring Western-style democracy, the Shiites would win the plurality, they would elect one of their own, and very soon we would have an alliance between Iraq and the hardliners in Iran, which is exactly precisely what we do not need on top of all of that oil. Now, the Bush administration is well aware of this. They're not stupid. So to talk about bringing democracy to Iraq is a falsehood on its face, because they're not going to do anything that would set up the kind of situation where Iraq and Iran were allied with each other on top of all of that oil. 17% of the country are the Kurds, and there's no way that they're going to let the Kurds run anything there because Turkey won't allow it. The Turks have been fighting the Kurds for decades now. The remaining group are the, I'm sorry, the 23% are the Kurds. The remaining group, the 17% remaining, are the Sunnis. Now, Saddam Hussein is a Sunni. His family, the Abu Nasir, out of Tikrit, have been running the Sunnis, who have been running the Ba'ath Party, who have been running the country. Now, the Sunni tribal politics are sort of like the Godfather, that last scene in the movie, The Godfather, when you have all of the families sitting around together at the table. If you were to walk past that, you walk by the door and look in, you'd think these Italian families are getting along great. In fact, they've been murdering and stabbing and killing and betraying amongst each other until one family rises to the top. And the Abu Nasir, Saddam Hussein's family, are the ones currently on top in Iraq. If we were to knock him off, the only remaining group of people who can run the place are the Sunnis, because they already control the Ba'ath Party. And Sunni tribal politics being what they are, once Saddam Hussein is gone, another Sunni family will rise through the craziness of Sunni tribal politics to run that whole group and therefore to run the Ba'ath Party, and pretty much everything would stay exactly as it has been. This talk about liberating the Iraqi people is nonsense, because another Sunni is in all likelihood going to wind up running the joint after Tommy Franks gets through, and will run the country exactly the same. The other possible person to come in there is a guy named Ahmed Chalabi, who is the head of the Iraqi National Congress, one of the most corrupt groups that are involved in this whole thing. Ahmed Chalabi has a wonderful Enron resume. He was convicted in 1992 of 31 counts of bank fraud in a Jordanian court and sentenced to 22 years in prison in absentia. He has not set foot in Iraq since 1956. I have absolutely no idea what his tribal background is, what he's most interested in getting his hand on the oil. So he's a potential person who could run the country after that. Whatever is going to happen is going to bring civil war. We are going to be doing constabulary duties in Iraq, and it's going to be chaos, and not any of it, not one little bit of it, not a dot of any of it is going to have to do with anything that even vaguely resembles democracy.
Meanwhile, back in this country, we're looking at an economy that could hit bottom here anytime soon. One of your articles, you mentioned the concept of Bush's trifecta. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's actually one of the weirder stories that came out of this. Al Gore, during the campaign, said that he would not go into a budget deficit unless war, recession, or national emergency came about. After September 11th, somehow or another, George Bush decided that he was the one who actually said this and was going around to all these campaign fundraising events saying, you know, I promised back in Chicago that I wouldn't go into deficit spending unless of war, national emergency, or recession. Lucky me, I hit the trifecta. He said it like 15 different times at 15 different events, as always to hearty laughter from the people in the crowd. I don't know that the rest of us really get the joke.
What is a trifecta for those that don't know?
A trifecta is a horse racing term. You pick the first three horses to come across the line and you win a hell of a lot of money. And hitting the trifecta is one of the rarest things you can do if you bet the ponies down at the track.
So it's generally considered something of extreme good fortune?
Oh, it's like winning the lottery.
What do you recommend to listeners to do at this point to get back our democracy here in the U.S.?
Now, first things first is turn off the damn television. Don't watch CNN. Don't watch MSNBC. Don't watch Fox. Don't watch any of the cable news stations because it's just a parade of nonsense. I think taking immediately to the streets in whatever form you possibly can at this point, if only to be able to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and distance yourself from the horror that we have just visited upon this city of 5 million people, again, half of whom are under 15, most of whom are too poor to get out of the way of all of this. There are protests being organized all across the country, some of them immediate, some of them happening in the next couple of days. Get online, type in the word Iraq protest into a Google search, and see what you can find, and join in. Call your representatives and let them know that you don't agree with this. Whatever you can do, any salutary effect, hang your flag upside down if that's your way of thinking. Put a sign in your yard, wear an armband, find a protest, find something to become involved in, and just, I tell people, when people look at me and say, what can I do in the face of all of this? What can I do to change things? And I tell people, whatever you do that allows you to look at yourself in the mirror in the morning is enough. And if more people made the effort to do something that allowed themselves to look themselves in the eye in the mirror, then things would probably begin to change. Not enough people do that. More people do. And if enough people go by their own internal compasses and do something that allows themselves to live with themselves in the face of all of this, then that is something that is getting accomplished.
I have to say that your articles are forwarded to me more often than any other writer that I can think of. How do people plug into your writings?
I write for a website called Truthout, truthout.org. Usually have something up once or twice a week on the right-hand column. People can do a search under, you put William Rivers Pitt in quotes into a Google search and you'll come up with, or William Rivers Pitt in quotes and then the word Truthout next to it. You can pretty much dig up everything that I've written over the past several months about this. There's an article up right now called Into the Darkness on Truthout that has at the bottom of it 7 or 10 or so articles that I've written since July, which would be a decent place to start, just to kind of, if people are interested in what I've been talking about for the last year or so, that would be a decent place to start.
All right, and you have a book coming out this summer, correct?
Yes, The Greatest Sedition is Silence is going to be available from Pluto Press, which should be hitting the shelves sometime in late May or June.
Well, I sincerely want to thank you for spending time with me today.
It's my pleasure, man.